I'm Christopher Lydon, asking the psychologist Paul Bloom at Yale what the booming brain sciences of our time are trying to tell us about who we human beings are. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. In this one, I'm taking Paul Bloom's invitation to see into the science of the age. It sticks with me, I should say, Paul, that as the Victorian critic Walter Pater said, all the arts aspire to the condition of music, so our best interdisciplinary minds and studies aspire to the condition of the cognitive sciences, of how the human mind works, down to the tiniest pulse of microscopic neurons. In the University core of New England, where we live, we have a world capital of the brain sciences, but who knows the questions they're working with, much less the answers. Paul Bloom, take us by the hand through this world. I've read your book, How Pleasure Works. You're talking about the lure of sex, food, art, religion, many other things. Give us the short form on not just the lure, but the feedback.
Well, it's an exciting time to do cognitive science, as you pointed out. It's a time where all these disciplines are converging: evolutionary biology, neuroscience, cognitive psychology, developmental psychology, which is my the field I focus on. And there's all sorts of exciting work done in some amazing domains. There's morality, which maybe we'll talk about later. But what my book is about pleasure. It's about the pleasures of everyday life. And I start by looking at food and sex, which are seemingly simple pleasures we share with other animals. And I move on to pleasures like the pleasures we get from owning certain objects, from appreciating art, from movies and books and television, all the way through to religious rituals, and finally religion itself and science. And what I try to do in my book is bring certain core ideas from the brain and cognitive sciences to bear to answer these classic questions. And an argument that runs through my book, which I think is an extraordinarily promising idea, which has been developed by many scholars over the last couple of decades, is that of essentialism. The idea of essentialism is that when we see something, when we name it, when we think about it, we respond not merely to its superficial features, but to what we believe it really is, to what we believe its deep, essential nature is. Now, this is standardly studied in when we look at babies and children and adults with regard to how what we call things and how we use things and how we think about things. But what I try to do is extend it to pleasure. So the argument I make, for instance, is that when we taste a food, the experience of the taste doesn't merely rest on its chemical composition. It's affected by what we think it is. When we sip some wine, it's not merely how it hits our taste buds and our olfactory bulbs, but rather what we think we're tasting. How old is it? Where was it made? When we look at somebody and we're sexually aroused or romantically moved, it critically matters who we think we're looking at. And I would argue this applies straight through. It applies most obviously to art, where the value of an artwork can go from being an extraordinary valuable piece to absolute garbage if it's discovered to be a forgery. It applies for movies and books, where we think it came from, what we think we're regarding, affects our pleasure. It even matters for things like science and religion, where how you frame things affects your experience of it.
For me, Paul, if I may say, music is always the test. And I've asked many people, including Steve Pinker and your friend Dan Levitin in Canada, what is the joy of music? Does it have evolutionary value or doesn't? Is it a spandrel or not? Take a shot at it.
Well, I'll say two things about music. One thing is I'll say that I fall under the category of people who see music as an evolutionary accident, a byproduct, a spandrel. Now, many people are aghast at this. This is a claim that Steven Pinker made. He called music auditory cheesecake. People were outraged. To say this doesn't diminish it. I also think the capacity for religion is an evolutionary accident, and I think the same about the capacity for science. And I think science is one of our great accomplishments, but I don't think it's evolved through natural selection. Music is wondrous and magnificent, but I've never heard a convincing account for how creatures with music have more offspring than those without.
Well, people have made it. It's a wonderful courting device. People make love to music, but it's also a badge of leisure, wealth, blah, blah, blah. I mean,
there are all sorts of benefits that once we have music, where it pays to have it. And it might be that a case could be made that this explains its origin. But in order to show that something's an adaptation, it sets a fairly high bar. You have to show that there's genetic variation in its capacity, and that this variation leads to more reproductive success on the part of those who have more of it. And it's not at all clear where a species that never had music, how it could come to have music through an evolutionary process. It's only useful as a courting device, for instance, if other people around, the people you're trying to court with, can appreciate it. So where did it come from? So one thing is I'm skeptical about adaptationist claim. But the second thing is music, and there's great mysteries as to why we enjoy it. But music is actually a very interesting example of the essentialism that I'm talking about, where there's now several demonstrations that what you think you're listening to, was it made by a great composer or by some guy on a subway? Was it created by a computer? Was it created by somebody with natural abilities versus somebody who worked very hard? All of these factors...
Is it played on the Stradivarius?
Yes, yes. What's the instrument? And all of these factors affect how you hear it, how you appreciate it. So we think about essentialism easily in the domain of the visual arts, where everyone would agree that who you think painted a painting affects how much people like it and how much they pay for it, but applies as well to music. Music isn't as simple as some would have it. Your appreciation of music relies on expertise, it relies on knowledge, it relies on culture, and this transfixes not just how you talk about it or think about it, but actually how you experience it.
Explain what's not simple about it. The pleasure in food, for example.
There's an account some people might be tempted by, which is that when we like food based on its nutrients, on how it feels in our mouth, salt, sugar. And when you say this, there's a huge grain of truth to that. Some things simply taste good. A baby's love of sweet milk, you don't need to appeal to essentialism for that. Babies' brains are wired up to like this taste over wasabi. There's some things that do taste better than others. But that's not the whole story. So what's not simple about the taste of food is that your perception of that taste can be powerfully influenced by what you know about it. I'll give you three quick examples. One is, you want to make children think that fruit and milk taste better? There's a simple way to do it. Take it out of a McDonald's bag. They not only are more willing to eat it, they say it tastes better because they have a belief system that says that things from McDonald's taste good. Second example, you want to make ice cream taste better? Tell people it's full fat. People know what full fat's supposed to taste like, and this influences them. The third example, which is an example that people like Joan Allaire and others have explored most extensively, because it matters the most to us, is wine. The price of wine profoundly affects how you taste it. I'm not an uncritical fan of neuroimaging studies, but there's one study I like where they got people inside an fMRI brain scanner. They put a tube in their mouths to shoot wine into. And as the people were sipping the wine, they saw on a screen in front of them information about the wine, including how much it costs. You give two groups of subjects exactly the same wine, but one group thinks it's really cheap, and they kind of enjoyed it. But the other group thinks it's expensive. They enjoy it far more, not only how they rate it, but also the pleasure centers that their brain respond differently. They sort of light up. And this suggests that your taste of wine is deep. It has to do with your beliefs about what it is you're drinking.
Paul Bloom, you mentioned neuroimaging and also so many other fields, evolutionary biology, neuroscience in general. People talk now a lot about behavioral economics, predictable irrationality, this kind of thing. Locate your own interest in the big family tree of cognitive sciences today.
In the big family tree, I would connect myself mostly with two disciplines, though like everybody I know, I draw upon just about everything that's out there. One discipline is developmental psychology. I think some of our great discoveries over the last several decades have come from the studies of babies and young children. And these discoveries have informed us about some of the, you know, the deepest questions that cut through the sciences and the humanities, questions having to do with how much of our capacities are hardwired, are part of our nature, and how much of them are malleable and affected by culture. I think you could learn from the study of children and babies not only questions about the origin of knowledge, but actually these studies can inform how adults work, what goes on in the adult mind. So that's one tradition. A second tradition I come from is from evolutionary theory. I see myself as an evolutionary psychologist. Now, there's a caricature of evolutionary psychologists. Those are the guys who think everything's an adaptation. That caricature is unfair. And it doesn't apply to me or anyone else I know. What it does imply is that we ask ourselves the question, how would natural selection evolve a mind? And that could mean that some things have a function, other things are accidents, other things are byproducts. As we mentioned before with regard to music, I think some very important human capacities, and I put music in that category, religion, I put certain aspects of human morality, are biological accidents. Other things are biological adaptations, a lot having to do with sex and food, and a lot of our morality are biological adaptations. And this way of asking the question, what's it for? Does it have a function or not? Can be extraordinarily important in how we study the mind. So the two fields I situate myself into are developmental psychology and evolutionary theory. A third, which has always informed my work, is philosophy, where I think that the boundaries between psychology as it's currently practiced and philosophy are very porous. And I benefited hugely from collaborations with philosophers.
Fascinating. How deep do you go into the fine-grained mapping of all these neurons that fire together and wire together, the spaghetti of the brain?
Well, I study the spaghetti of the brain by doing experiments, by looking at how babies and how children and how adults reason about certain things. So I study the brain without getting into the particular spaghetti, without doing neuroimaging or single-cell recording. And in that way, I think I'm like 99% of psychologists. I think the way things are now, certainly the mind emerges from the brain. I don't know anyone these days who's a substance dualist, who believes the mind is an ephemeral substance separate from its physical instantiation. But the way it turns out is the best way to learn about the brain isn't to put people in a brain scanner. It isn't to put electrodes on them. Those are very useful for certain questions. But the best way to learn about the brain is to sit in front of somebody and talk to them. Ask them how they respond. The best way to learn about the developing brain of a baby is to do the sort of experiments I do with my colleagues, where we might show babies different situations and see how they respond. The best way to look at the brain structures relevant to food isn't to do an autopsy or a brain scan. It's to see what people eat, and to see what people like to eat, and how it could affect how they like to eat.
I'm just one of those citizens who is painfully aware that there's a booming industry in cognitive science all around me, and I don't know what they're up to. I don't know what they're thinking about, you know, those ancient human questions. Maybe we should talk about them, but including good and evil, including this matter of the ghost in the machine, spirit and substance in the human being, in the human experience. As Joan Alara says, you know, we can talk about the machine, and maybe that's all there is, and yet we experience it, no matter what, as the ghost. Walk us through this field of yours and sort of show us what's going on.
Well, what Jonah says is exactly right. I've argued, and so have many of my colleagues, that humans are common sense dualists. We naturally think of ourselves as separate from our brains. We don't feel as if we are physical things. We feel as if we are minds that can be liberated from our physical bodies. Most people believe in life after death, that when the body turns to dust, you will still survive. Most people believe that they can leave their body, that there are creatures without bodies, like gods and angels and demons.
And zombies.
And zombies. Zombies, I guess, are bodies without corresponding minds. You could factor them out. You could have minds without bodies, as in a ghost, and you could have bodies without minds, as in a zombie. This is all common sense, and it's common sense that's at the core of many religious ideas and some secular ideas, some secular moral ideas, too, where many people look at moral questions revolving around animal rights or abortion in terms of the question, does it or does it not have a soul? Where a soul is something separate from the body that some creatures possess and some people don't. That's common sense. One of the great accomplishments, I think, of the neurosciences and the cognitive sciences more generally is to show that this is false, that every aspect of our mental life emerges from our physical brain. Now, what are the implications of this? How do we study this? This work goes off in 100 directions. The directions I'm most interested in are pleasure, which we've been talking about, and as another one, morality.
Talk about it.
Morality used to be a taboo topic. there were very few psychologists, and again, mostly developmental psychologists, who asked about our sense of good and evil, of right and wrong. More recently, though, there's been a huge interest in it. And I think this huge interest has come from many directions, an understanding of the sophisticated theories of moral philosophers, evolutionary biologists who have begun to ask over the last many years the question of why would an animal evolve to help another? Why would an animal evolve to feel pain at the suffering of another? Why would an animal evolve to have a sense of right and wrong? And to what extent do you see all of these things in chimpanzees and macaques and dogs and other creatures? And this work has sort of started to converge, where people are asking, and I think this is there are two core questions that people argue about now. One is what I'm most involved in, the question of how much of an understanding of good and evil is there from the very start. The second one turns to children, but also to adults, and asks the question, to what extent is our understanding of right and wrong, your beliefs about the Iraq war, or rape, or slavery, or abortion, to what extent are your particular beliefs the product of a rational reasoning process, as opposed to gut emotional intuitions? Mm. And those are the two big debates in the fields of moral psychology.
Spin out the debate. I'm also thinking of E.O. Wilson's ants and an instinct for survival or for community or for altruism, which becomes suddenly kind of urgent when you think of the state of the planet and the climate and all these things too. But
well, I'll spin out the debate in a way that speaks to that issue and speaks across the different people arguing. In my own work, and this is some work I've done at Yale in collaboration with my colleague and my wife, Karen Wynn, and also with Kylie Hamlin, who's a graduate student here, off to University of British Columbia, we've been studying young babies and young babies' intuitions about good and evil. And so we use all sorts of methods to look at how they assess the actions of others, what they think deserves reward, what they think deserves punishment, who's worth associating with, who's not. And we've done this with babies who are 18-month-olds, 12-month-olds, 6-month-olds, even in some studies, 3-month-olds. And what we find is that there's a sophisticated knowledge early on, a sophisticated understanding of at least the foundations of morality. Now, this speaks to questions about adults' understanding, because these babies are not reasoning their way through moral dilemmas. They're figuring it out by an emotional response, by their gut. And I think that this persists through adulthood. I think we walk around with a moral sense that's largely identical to that we had when we were toddlers, when we were babies. And this is not entirely a good thing, because the moral sense that babies possess, I think, is actually narrow. It's narrow in that it reflects an evolutionary history directed towards being kind to your immediate close kin, to those around you, and a disregard, even a hatred and a fear of strangers. So one of the accomplishments of humanity, of culture, of science, of society, is for us to expand and elaborate on this original moral sense and become really better people who care about strangers, who have a sense of justice and fairness and so on. And that isn't evolved. That is the part of morality that doesn't come for free. That's a cultural and social accomplishment.
What is the connection with the collective consciousness of an anthill, for example?
Well, the unfortunate fact in some regards is that our genetic structure is not that of ants. Our genetic structure is different, so that we are of close kin, our parents, our children, our siblings. And then once you get around that fairly small circle, the kinship diminishes. We don't share our genes, particular genes, with these large communities of people. We are much more related to our children, our parents, our siblings, than we are to anyone else. And that is reflected in our morality. It is reflected in the very parochial structure of our morality. Now, what we want to do is change this to some extent. I don't think we're ever going to have a case where people don't love their children more than they love other children. And I'm not even sure we ever should have that. But what I do hope we have is a case where people at least care somewhat about the children of others. The psychologist Jonathan Haidt has a wonderful quote, and I'm going to mangle this, but the main thrust of the quote is, what we want from our morality is to, in some way, become less like primates and more like insects, in that we care more for others And we don't have this sort of very, very narrow moral scope.
What's the evolutionary history of that? Why did ants come to a better sense of community than we have?
Well, I would defer to E.O. Wilson for the details, but my understanding is that the history of that has to do with the genetic structure of ants, with the family relations. So the family relations we have as primates is we have relatively few offspring and a strong genetic tie to them. I can't speak for ants, but my understanding is the story is very different.
Come back to the morality of babies. How does their sense of morality become a matter of right and wrong?
Well, I'll tell you about the studies we do,
and
you could tell me whether you see this as morality. What we do is we show babies one-act plays with a good guy and a bad guy by adult lights. So, for instance, we might show them a character struggling to get up a hill. One character goes behind him and gently helps him up. Another one shoves him down. We might show a character trying to open up a box. One character goes up and opens the box. The other one jumps on it, slams it shut. We show a character playing with a ball, and one character passes it back and forth. The other one runs away with it. We show it to six-month-olds, to three-month-olds in some studies.
These are puppets? These are videos? These are real life or what?
We've done these experiments with videos of animated characters. We've done them with geometrical figures like squares and circles and triangles. And we've done these with puppets. And we're planning to do them with real live people. You would think those are the first things we do, but for methodological reasons, to keep it simple, we want to have the character sort of small and safe. We don't want to frighten the children, for one thing. So we're trying to figure out some way of doing it with people.
And how do you read the reaction of a six-month-old?
So the question is, you show the babies these scenes on video in real life, and then how do you know how they respond? Well, there's different answers. With the younger babies, you see where they look, based on the logic that they look at characters they like more. And for the ones I've described, we find that babies look at the good guys. They don't look at the bad guys. As they get older, six-month-olds, you see where they reach. And you find they reach for the good guys and not for the bad guys. Then it gets more interesting. When you get to babies who are 1 year old, approaching toddlerhood, you can see who they reward by giving them candy to pass out. They reward the good guys, not the bad guys. Then you could see who they punish. You tell them the treats are in short supply, you have to take them from somebody. And there they punish the bad guys and not the good guys. Then you could ramp that up. And we did this ramping up with eight-month-olds. You have a good guy and a bad guy. Then you bring in other characters. One character is nice to the good guy and cruel to the bad guy. Mm. Babies like him. A second character is nice to the bad guy and cruel to the good guy. Just the same amount of niceness and cruelty, but now by adult lights misdirected, babies don't like him, suggesting there's a rudimentary sense of justice, a sense of some people deserve goodness, some people deserve badness, and a character who comes in and gets that mixed up is not a character I wish to associate with.
So what is the moral chain of judgment here that kids seem to know naturally?
I think what we have here at minimum is the capacity to observe interactions, third-party interactions that you yourself are not involved in, and make judgments. Make judgments that this is a good guy and this is a bad guy. These are unfamiliar situations. The babies have never seen some of them before, but they make judgments. Armed with these judgments, things follow. The good guy is that which is better to hang out with than a bad guy. Mm. The good guy deserves reward. The bad guy deserves punishment. On top of that, it applies sort of on a second order level where someone who rewards a good guy is good. Someone who rewards a bad guy is bad. You shouldn't reward a bad guy. Now, once you move away from these younger babies and toddlers, you can do experiments looking at their own altruistic behavior. So move away from moral judgment to moral action. And some of the best work here is done by Felix Varnikin at Harvard, in collaboration with Michael Tomasello. And what Varnikin and Tomasello do is they take young toddlers and they put them in situations where someone's in trouble. They're reaching for something. They're trying to open a door. And what they find is that the toddlers, with no encouragement, no one telling them to do something, no eye contact, nothing like that, will typically rush out to help. And this dovetails nicely with more informal observations showing that even babies before their first birthday, are sensitive to the pain of others. Hmm. And they'll often try to soothe other creatures in pain. Now, Varnikin and Tomasello did something interesting. They ran the same studies with chimpanzees, looking to see how chimps would respond to humans in trouble. And the answer is, they did, but not to the same extent or the same generality as human children. And this speaks to a general debate where I'm somewhat agnostic about, to the extent that the moral capacities we're talking about now extend to other primates.
What does it tell you about this general division between a notion of people as associative, communitarian cooperators on one side, and on the other, competitive individuals, you know, on the way to becoming warriors?
So plainly, we have both impulses within us. And I think if you scratch a one-year-old, you'd see the impulses within the one-year-old. The impulse to establish community, connection, reciprocity, emotions like love and caring, but also strong self-interest mixed in with, I think, disregard, fear of strangers. So one way to talk about these two impulses is the more positive impulse, they both live within us, but the more positive impulse is most naturally extended to kin, to friends. The cruel impulse has broad scope, but I think it's extended to everyone else in the world. Again, I think what babies have to outlearn, I think where socialization and culture plays in, is extending this compassion and kindness to others, to anonymous strangers, to people in faraway lands. And so much of culture, so much of society and development consists of doing what Peter Singer described as expanding the moral circle, taking it away from this very, very narrow scope we start with and extending it towards others. And you were asking before about exciting movements in the cognitive sciences.
Yeah.
One such movement that a lot of people are interested in is the mechanisms underlying this expansion. It's something which Steven Pinker at Harvard is working on, Robert Wright has studied, Joe Henrich at UBC, looking at the different factors that come into play that basically cause humans to become nicer. And we could think of a list. So one factor that causes people to become nicer is immersion in large social groups, like a world religion. Henrich finds in a survey across cultures that people who identify themselves as part of a major world religion, like Christianity or Islam, tend to be nicer to strangers than others, because presumably because their moral circle has been expanded to include many people they don't normally see. Henrich also finds, and this is somewhat surprising, that market economies, capitalism, tends to make people on the whole nicer. So there's a stereotype that capitalism makes you mean. But actually what capitalism does is it forces you to trade and deal with others, often others you don't see. And this establishes norms of fairness and reciprocity. A third factor that I'm most interested in as a psychologist is the role of stories, both fictional stories and journalism. Because what stories do is they take people you would have never encountered before, and they make them as if they were your friends, as if they were your family. You see pictures, you hear descriptions, and as a result, your empathy, which has evolved to extend primarily to people who are close to you, your empathy can extend to them. I think some of the great moral changes that have happened in my lifetime are the result of stories and fiction. So if I had to think of the great moral change that's happened in the last 10 years, it's probably attitudes towards homosexuals, which has profoundly changed. And then you ask the question, why has it changed, say, in the United States? The answer to me isn't because people were persuaded by philosophical or political or legal arguments. It's rather because in movies and on television, they've been exposed to positive gay figures. And as a result, they become familiar vicariously with people they would have otherwise rejected. And as a result of that, their moral circle has expanded.
Which ones in particular? I mean, I immediately think of Rock Hudson. Who knew he was gay?
I guess the most common example, most recent example, is Dumbledore. But but I'm thinking, say, of TV shows such as Will and Grace.
Yeah.
Which portrayed sympathetic gay characters in the same way that the Cosby Show, many years before, has been argued to actually cause a very deep shift in Americans' response and reactions to African Americans. In the very same way that Uncle Tom's Cabin is said by many to have been a defining force in the end of American slavery. And in the same way as Greek tragedies, and Martha Nussbaum talks about this, changed the attitudes of Greeks towards the people they would never see. So fiction has this power, We are hardwired to be kind to those who are close to us, who are face to face, who are our family. And what fiction does is it takes people and it gives us the illusion that they're close to us. And as a result of this wonderful illusion, our moral circle might expand to include them.
That's fascinating. You introduced the personal element, which I wanted to get to. When I wonder, how is cognitive science changing our notions of the human? I wonder what of your own preconceptions as a little kid have been challenged, changed, contradicted, expanded by your professional work.
I probably think, like most kids, I was a dualist. Most of the kids you look at believe that they are separate from their bodies. When you ask them directly or indirectly, they believe they're immaterial things. And most people believe that. I think cognitive science has overturned that. I think, like most kids, I probably was, to some extent, a common sense theist. Now, cognitive science doesn't overthrow theism. But what cognitive science does is it makes you question certain beliefs, such as the belief that all complex things, including our minds, including our brains, emerge as a result of an intelligent designer. It opens up the possibility of an alternative, which is that this complexity emerges through biological evolution. I guess a third change which has occurred with me is I used to believe that at stages of my life, I used to believe people were naturally good. And then at different stages of my life, I used to believe people were naturally bad. And now I think what I know from reading what my colleagues have to say and what they've studied on morality, that the question to are humans intrinsically good or bad is yes. That we see within ourselves both a goodness and an evil. And that the story is far more complicated than the younger me would have had it.
Fascinating. I think I'm still a dualist, but it's funny. You can introspect on the subject of the dualist, the spirit and the body, and say, but wait a sec, in my spiritual, eternal, untouchable dimension, am I white? Am I tall? Am I male? Am I Chinese? Am I African? You can spin that one out too.
Well, one way to answer this question, and I think the answer to many of your questions is yes, for your common sense view, is you ask people what will happen when they die. And what most people say is when they die, they'll experience some sort of afterlife. And then you ask them, in your afterlife, do you speak English? Are you white? Are you still a man? And
it's all music by then, I think.
And then I think most people's common sense about heaven, for instance, is they retain very much of themselves, very much of their identity.
You know, Joan O'Lara knows more about neuroscience than I ever will. But in a funny way, his book on Proust was a neuroscientist. Rejects the whole idea in the sense that he really believes and establishes in many dimensions that artists get there first, that Walt Whitman understood the kind of the body electric before the neuroscientist did, that Proust dug deep into memory and many other examples of not just literary artists, but cooks and dancers and whatnot. How do your own prejudices and your own debts to philosophy and literature work out with your experimental discoveries as a psychologist?
Well, I'm hugely sympathetic to the point that Jonah's making. And I would distinguish two questions that often get run together, but it's very important to keep them separate. One question is it true that that our mental life is a product of our brains, of our neurons? The answer I see it is an unequivocal yes. Our brains give rise to consciousness and thought and everything of value. The second question is the best way to learn about the mind by studying the brain? My answer is, right now, probably not. Probably you'd learn more about the mind from the insights of artists and writers, and then as you move to more scientific approaches, from standard experimental psychology. So in my book on pleasure, I explore all these pleasures, sex and food and movies and so on, and I draw upon the literature, all the literature I could find. And some of this literature is from neuroscience, and there's some wonderful and elegant research from neuroscience. But right now, I think we have a far richer source of information from the work of experimental psychologists, from the work of developmental psychologists, from anthropologists, from philosophers, and then expanding the net even wider, the insights of people who study literature, the insights of writers themselves, of artists themselves. So Jonah, I think, is being exactly right when he says that when it comes to learning about the mind, studying the brain directly may not always be the right way to go.
What do Yale students in 2010 want to know about psychology, and what are you giving them? I heard Steve Pinker once say that psychology, as it's taught today, with the heavy neuroscience part of it, doesn't answer any of the questions that we really want to answer, including our dreams, our love life, our eternity, the rest.
I think it's fair to say that when students enter an intro psych course, including my own, they often feel, I'm not sure if the term is sticker shock, but they feel...
buyer's remorse, maybe?
Buyer's remorse is probably better. They say, I've come in with questions about myself, these profound questions. And there's some guy standing up, he's telling me about neurons. Then he's telling me about Piaget, then Freud. And he's never really answering any of the real hard questions I came in with. I think this is fair. So I'll add a note of humility here, which is there's these incredibly deep, personal, intimate questions we have. And psychology is very far from answering any of them. It is, in many ways, a young science, or at least not yet very successful science. And some of the hardest and most interesting questions are still mysteries to us. It's one reason I love this field so much. There's so much left to do. What I want to say in a defense of psychology and in defense of a really good intro psych course, like the one I'm sure Steve Pinker teaches at Harvard and many others I've heard of, in defense of that course is we're at least now asking some really nice questions. We're now talking about what people find sexually attractive. Why do we dream? What's the source of mental illness? What motivates people from day to day? What's the source of experiences like shame and guilt and pride and happiness? I think we're far from answering any of the questions, but I think cognitive science has at least reached a point where we can approach them and in some cases say some things that are surprising. Say some things that the students, A, didn't know before they entered the room, and B, they walk away thinking, wow, that's a discovery. And it's one that is a discovery on something I'm really interested in.
So what are you feeding them?
I'm feeding them morality, because I think the science of moral psychology, both babies and young children, is full of surprises. I think students, for instance, are highly surprised when they learn how much of their moral beliefs, their sense of right and wrong, is the result of their gut feelings and their emotions and their culture, as opposed to their reason. I'm feeding them pleasure, making the case that our pleasures, even as pleasures of sex and food, two aspects of daily life college students are intimately familiar with, are affected by their beliefs. For example, sex. You might think that that how sexually attractive you find somebody, say a heterosexual man looking at a woman, depends on what she looks like, on the ratio between her waist and her hips, the symmetry of her face. And to some extent, that's true. But it's not the whole story. It's not even the most interesting part of the story. It turns out that how attractive you find her will rest on factors such as how familiar she is. The more you've seen her up to a point, the better she'll look to you, even if you never spoke. It will depend on how much you like her. There's a reliable connection between how much you like somebody and how good-looking you think they are. It will depend, even in cases of, say, pornography, who you think you're looking at. Are you looking at an actress you've always admired, or are you looking at her twin sister? Well, that'll make a difference.
What's the difference with the twin sister?
Well, there's an attraction to some people where you may really want to look at them. You may really want to look at them without clothes. But what's interesting, and if you see this in the market for pictures of this sort, is they extend to only to that person. They don't extend to people who look like her, even if you couldn't tell from the picture who's who. Magazines and websites have paid a fortune for pictures of unclothed or partially unclothed famous people. Even if these pictures are taken from a telephoto lens and are so blurry, you could be looking at anybody. But what's arousing is your knowledge of who it is you're looking at. I'll give you the flip side, which is, and this applies to both men and women, but imagine you see your spouse naked, your spouse of many years. It would be presumably unacceptable. You've seen your spouse naked many times. Now imagine seeing your spouse's twin brother or twin sister. The perceptual experience would be presumably identical. You're looking at what is to your eyes the same body. But my bet is the psychological experience would not be identical. Your knowledge of who it is you're looking at would affect your sexual desire.
Paul Bloom, you speak of the work yet to be done. Point to three mountaintops out there that you'd love to climb. Areas that we haven't mentioned yet, by way of illustration.
Religion. I think that there's a lot of people now exploring why people believe in God, the nature of religious belief. People who are themselves atheists, who are people who are themselves deeply religious. And this is an area, I think, of huge excitement, but I think now the field is too immature.
What did William James leave untouched in the varieties of religious experience?
William James was wonderful on religious experience. He was not so good on the question of, on the why question. But why does everybody, most everybody, believe in some sort of God? Why does most everybody believe in an afterlife? The same questions you raised with regard to music apply here. To what extent is this a biological adaptation? Smart people believe it is. Or to what extent is it an accident?
The believers have more babies.
That would be the claim. Because they're happier, because they're more socially connected, because their belief in God makes them more moral and their morality makes them more attractive. But then there's people, other smart people, including many people I work with, who would argue that religious belief is an accident. We've never evolved to be religious. Rather, it's a byproduct of capacities that we've evolved for other purposes. So that's one, religion.
I love the psalm that says, "As the hart panteth after the water brook, so my heart longeth for the living God." Pretty deep and old and basic.
Pretty deep, and it also captures the fact that religion is not merely an intellectual stance. I end How Pleasure Works by talking about religious ritual and religious belief, and I point out, and I'm an atheist myself, but I point out that I'd have to be blind and deaf not to realize the pleasure it causes many people, the satisfaction it gives them. And I think this is an important part of why we have it. Second mountain, a particular sort of pleasure, stories, fiction. Your average person spends much of his or her day engaged in worlds that are not real. We read books, we watch TV, we go to movies, we daydream. The number one pleasure of your life is engaging in your imagination. It's not sex, it's not food, it's not drugs, it's not sports, it's not hanging around with those you love. It is living in imaginary worlds. Mm. And what we don't know is why this is so appealing. Why is it so appealing to, for a moment, find yourself in a world that you know is not real? Why is it so appealing, and what are the constraints on this? What sort of stories do people like? To what extent are there universals in these sort of stories? What's the relationship between the sort of stories a two-year-old would enjoy and that you and I would enjoy? Or that you and I would enjoy and a hunter-gatherer would enjoy? What are the universals? What are the particulars? And given the importance of this to our day-to-day lives, It's unfortunate and surprising, but exciting that we don't know the answers to this. And this is, I think, a wonderful field for future research.
Paul Bloom, if a Martian landed and said, "I know cognitive science is a big business in your part of the world, take me to three labs, three people that we ought to know about back in Mars," where would you take them?
Here are my three, off the top of my head.
Good.
They're all going to be terribly biased, but what would you expect of a question like that? The first one is Karen Wynn's baby lab, because in this lab, they're doing the morality studies I was talking about.
This is right here at home.
It is. If you were to leave this door and walk 20 feet down the hall, you'd be there.
What would I see?
You would see testing babies on a range of things, including morality, including social knowledge, including how they sort the world into social groups. How does a boy baby treat a man versus a woman? How does a baby who's white treat a white person versus a black person? How does a baby who you put a red t-shirt on treat two individuals, one with a red t-shirt and one with a green t-shirt? And you think, well, it's ridiculous. What difference does it make? It makes a huge difference for the babies that they study. The slightest hint that there's a group difference triggers all sorts of social affiliations. And to me, that's huge. The second lab I would take you to is my colleague, Lori Santos. And I take you to two labs. She has a lab which studies capuchin monkeys in the Yale Medical School. And she has another lab in Cayo, San Diego, which studies, I think they're rhesus macaques. In any case, they're larger primates. And in these labs, you would see them studying these non-human primates on all sorts of things. Their understanding of social relations, their understanding of the beliefs of others, of material objects, of behavioral economics. So Lori is one of the very few comparative behavioral economists in that she's one of the only people studying these staples of behavioral economics, like loss aversion or the endowment effect, where somebody becomes worth more just because you own it, and studying these in creatures that aren't human. It is an extraordinarily interesting research program. The third lab I would take you to is I would take you to England, and I would take you to Bristol, where I take you to the lab of Bruce Hood, because Bruce Hood studies magic. He doesn't study magic. He studies our beliefs about magic. He studies our superstitions, our religious beliefs that verge on magic. So he studies, for instance, why something could be seen as unlucky or lucky. Why something could be seen as contaminated by something. He studies what you might call voodoo beliefs, where he has subjects take a precious object and he photographs them. And then in front of their eyes, he cuts the photograph into pieces. And people don't like this one bit. And he does some of these studies while they're hooked up to GSR devices, which monitor their physiological responses. And even if they know full well it's just a picture, they respond to it at a gut level.
That's completely fascinating, and it gives me a plausible map of a territory I want to walk.
I'm admittedly biased, but if I could take somebody who was deciding what scientific field to go into, out of all of the ones in the world, hell, include humanities and everything, I'd direct them towards cognitive science. Not because we've solved everything, but precisely because I think we're in this delicious midpoint where we now have the right methods and theories to ask the hard questions, but we haven't yet answered them. And so it's a wonderful field to go into.
No wonder they aspire to the condition of cognitive science as once to music. Paul Bloom, completely fascinating. I think we can give course credit to anybody who listens all the way through. It's been a pleasure. Thank you enormously.
Thank you so much for having me do this. This was great.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.